This is CliffCentral.com.
Please note that the views expressed and the advice provided in this show are for general advice and entertainment purposes only. Nothing stated should be treated as a substitute for your own independent legal advice based on your own specific facts and objectives. Therefore, the presenter and CliffCentral.com accept no liability of any nature whatsoever, either expressed or implied.
Law, like you've never heard it before. The Laws of Life, with Gary Hertzberg on CliffCentral.com.
I'm Gary Hertzberg, and this is the Laws of Life on CliffCentral.com. Alongside me today, Lionel Makoko-Tlela. Welcome, Lions.
Dumela, Gary, and Dumela to our podcasters and our guest today.
Today we're discussing intellectual property.
What's that?
Yeah, we're going to learn all about it. We're going to ask whether your business, well, that's what we're asking now, whether your business concepts are sufficiently protected. And if not, you've got to really listen to this one. Can your competitor or your best friend duplicate your success and sell your ideas as their own? It happens so often, as we know, Lions. Mm-hmm. Protecting your ideas is a must in today's dog-eat-dog world. That was for you, Lion.
Oh, yeah, that's a rock and roll.
Yeah, it's by Genocide.
Hey, yeah. DJ.
Oh, sorry, Genocide by the Offspring.
DJ, yeah. You make it happen all the time. Great music selection.
In a dog-eat-dog world, Lion's business often means that someone wants to scale your ideas, as we say.
Unfortunately.
Yeah, therefore, it's imperative that you protect one of your most important assets, and that is your intellectual property, and there's no one better in this town to explain to you how to protect yourself and your company. So we've invited into our studio intellectual property specialist attorney Jeremy Kingsbury. He's from KIGR.co.za. Welcome to you, Jeremy.
Welcome. Thank you very much.
Cool. Our email address, law@cliffcentral.com. Let us hear from you. Lion, do you want to give out the Twitter handle?
It's Hertzlaw, H-E-R-T-Z-L-A-W. And you can just give us a tweet and just like our page.
Our Facebook page, The Laws of Life with Gary Hertzberg.
That's amazing.
Some of the questions we are taking today, and there are tons of them on the very topic, have been posted by members of our collaborative partner, Legal Talk South Africa, with their membership of 160,000 people. Amazing.
Amazing. That's right.
By the way, on the issue of numbers, our very own Gareth Cliff, who owns this very platform, has 1.8 million Twitter followers. Did you know that?
Whoa, no, I didn't know that.
Every time he opens his mouth or he tweets something, 1.8 million people have the pleasure of hearing what Gareth has to say. Amazing, wow. Isn't it?
That's great.
That's in addition to our hundreds of thousands of people on the social platforms that form part of Cliff Central, the social media side. Now, quickly, if you haven't yet downloaded the Cliff Central app, then you're living in the dark ages. Even a tech imbecile like myself has it downloaded. And after the show, it takes me literally 30 seconds to download it in a Wi-Fi environment, and I play my program to myself over and over. No, I don't. I listen to all the programs, and it's downloaded in really 30 seconds in a Wi-Fi environment, and then I play it in my car through the speakers. They're amazing.
Great.
You do the same, Lions?
No, I do all the time.
Cool. Jeremy Kingsbury, one of the people that people look up to on the intellectual property side. Jera, let's talk. I don't know how we're going to split this up. There's so much to intellectual property law. Let's talk about intangibles. I hear the word intangibles. What are intangibles and what can you protect?
The intangibles is basically what intellectual property is, because they're not concrete assets. So when you talk about intangibles, you're looking at things like copyright, trademarks, patents, and even to an extent there's a specialist position in advertising. Now, the intangibles goes further, because there's something called intellectual capital. which relates to technical know-how, and that's often more important because that relates to information and abilities of people and their skills.
Mm-hmm.
So then that gets broken down to something called show-how, where, for example, there's a process and only certain people know how to do it, and know-how, where a person has the technical ability to do a particular job. It becomes very relevant because you can have all the technology in the world, but if you don't have the people with the know-how to operate it, it can be devastating.
Mm.
The problem with the know-how is that cannot be registered. That is protected contractually.
Okay, Jerry, you do have an LLM, which is a Master's in Law. Is it on the subject of intellectual property? Or
it's intellectual property and commercial law.
Okay, cool. Not many guys walking around with that Master's, or are there?
Don't be modest.
We'd like to boost you a little. Okay, let's maybe break this down. We'll deal with a bit of copyright, then we'll go to trademark, and then we'll move on to intellectual capital. We'll do them all today. Every day of the year, there are people, I guess, in an office that are creating something that's special when you think about it, really. Copyright covers emails and letters and legal documents, I guess, articles, computer programs, spreadsheets, scientific models, and you can go on and on. Some people in the photographic business are creating photos. And then there are people that are, I suppose, creating sound recordings, films, and works. The question is, how do these people go about protecting their creations so that they're not infringed? There's a two-part question. And if you're working on a job, who does it belong to? Does it belong to the employer or the employee?
Okay, there's quite a lot to put in. But basically, you talk about copyright there,
yes,
which is traditionally for artistic works. But you mentioned other things such as computer programs. Now, in copyright per se, it's not a registrable right, with the exceptions of computer programs where you can actually file a patent for it,
mm-hmm,
and you protect the end function. It's generally not advisable because with that you give over the source code. So mm-hmm, a lot of companies nowadays, they rather keep trade secrets, and they put the source code in an escrow account and locked away. But
Will you explain that in more detail a little later, or you want to?
No, I'll explain it now. What happens is that with source code, there's open source, which is available to all. But if it's high tech software, it's not done in open source. It's protected, mm-hmm, and it's often encrypted, so it can't be copied because the commands are in a format which makes it difficult to copy and paste. So the original source code is often locked away.
If you want to patent it, then you've got to give away.
Yes, you see, the problem is if you want to patent the software,
yes,
you've actually got to expose the source code. So
yeah,
when you file the patent spec, you've not only got to show the source code, you've also got to show how it operates.
And who gets to see that?
Well, until it's registered, when it's pending, it's not available to public inspection. So in the pending stage, when it's registered, then it's open to all.
Mm.
And the problem with that is that because there's such a lot of source code out there, if you change a few of certain lines of the code, you fall outside the scope, because the protection you get is anything which departs from what exists. And because there's such a lot of source code out there, your protection is limited. It was different then to that 20 odd years ago when there wasn't a lot and people were filing more. So more because there wasn't a lot out there. So that backfires, that approach. In regard to...
Sorry, someone walks into your office and says, we've got something novel. It's magnificent.
In terms of software?
Yeah.
You see, the functionality is important, but the thing is, they should keep that as a trade secret.
How do you do that?
Well, and you can encrypt the software, so it's difficult to copy.
Yes.
And what happens is you buy licenses. So what in effect happens is, if you want to use it, you get a license.
Uh-huh.
And you download, and it's normally a click agreement, Shrimprec license, and you pay a subscription fee. And that's the best way to do it. to protect it, that would be a software engineer who would put encryption in, mm-hmm. so that it's difficult to cut and paste, because in practice it does happen. I'll tell you also, for example, a lot of companies, they have Microsoft licenses, but they share the licenses. Mm-hmm. So it's very hard to police. There are fora out there which do police it, and it has to work on honesty. The aspect is, if you create the software yourself and it's your business, the best way to protect it is contractually, because you can often prove when someone's using it. Mm-hmm. Because if it's unique, there's very few people who can create it. But it gets also...
Go on.
It gets more complicated, because when you look at systems like SAP and even the Oracle systems, you buy a base system, which is... it could be... an operating system, and then what happens is you can make it bespoke. So mm-hmm. you buy the basic SAP system, and then you design it to help you. For example, you buy our basic ERP system and you develop it. And the problem happens, which is that when you do the developments, in terms of the license agreements, all those, for example, in SAP, it goes back to SAP. Mm-hmm. There has been problems. One of the big mining companies worked on a system, did huge developments on it, and then they on-sold it to another mining company. Mm-hmm. And SAP came along and said, no, you can't do that, because all the amendments, modification, and the bespoke source code mm-hmm. actually belongs to us in terms of the license agreement. So the type of protection you've got, if you've got a valuable asset such as an IP in software, is to contractually reserve it.
The question then is, who owns it if it's been developed by an employee?
If it's developed by an employee and it's in the course and scope of his employment, then unless it's contrary to his employment contract, the employer has it. So if you are employed to create software, or you're employed in the engineering department, and you develop technical output, such as source code, then automatically that vests in the employer. Mm. But if it's not in the course and scope of employment, then it would vest in the employee. That's provided he doesn't use his employer's resources. I'll give you a practical example. If you're employed as an accountant in a company, and in your lunch hour, you sit there and you create amazing software unrelated to your job, it belongs to the employee unless it's contrary to his employment contract. The employer could argue, but you're using the employer's resources and therefore mm-hmm. it belongs to him. But the reality is, if you're working on someone's computer in lunchtime, you're not really using his resources. It's not like you're working in a laboratory and creating, using expensive resources.
So the software, the developed software, is always belongs to the employer. Even after the employee leaves, it makes no difference. It's always in the hands of the employer.
If it's created while he's in the employ,
in the course and scope.
Course and scope, yes. Yeah. When he leaves, it's still, if it belongs to the employer. There's specialized legislation, for example, the CSIR, which is quite harsh, which holds that anything you create within a year after you terminate employment, irrespective, even if it wasn't created during your employee, belongs to the CSIR. Yeah. The reason being is they employ people primarily to do research and development.
For a year after you've left their employer,
so
it belongs
to them. Even if you do it totally unrelated to work and it's a year afterwards.
Is this by law, operation of
law,
or
special legislation?
Except for that, the employer-employee relationship, is it by operation of law that it belongs to the employer, or is it by contract?
Well, the Copyright Act stipulates where the ownership vests, which is quite clear, but that can be overridden through contract, because you're entitled to contract out of what the Copyright Act says.
I think the issue here, Jer, is that do employers need to see someone like yourself to put it in the employment contract.
Yes, because in terms of the employment contract, you can take away a lot of rights or you can give away a lot of rights. Mm. And it's also often difficult to prove if it's not an employment contract, what's in the course and scope of employment. Because if you want to take it, delve deeper, if you employ an accountant and he creates advanced software, but it relates to accounting, strictly speaking, you could argue it does or does not fall within his employment contract.
Yes.
So then you enter into that terrible thing of judicial interpretation and the grey areas.
You don't want to go there.
And then you into fights which are costly, emotionally draining, and not worthwhile. And coming back to your issue of employee, the more senior the employee, such as a director, he's got a fiduciary duty to his employer. Mm. So he cannot go he's got stronger restrictions once he leaves the employ of his last company, which then leads to the next issue. You talk about employment contract, to put it in, is an aspect of a restraint, not only a restraint of trade, a restraint of what you can do. Mm. The problem with restraints is there's a constitutional right that people are entitled to, quite rightly, make a living. Yes. And the restraints of trade are generally very hard to implement and enforce. So the restraint of trade should be done in conjunction with the employment contract if you're an employer, to enforce it properly.
Let's take some of the questions that have come through from our Legal Talk South Africa members. One of them, we'll just fire them at you, Gio. When a person is the author of a piece of written work, in this case poetry, it comes from Henry, do you have to copyright it or is it automatically protected? Explain whether copyright is automatic or not, really.
Copyright vests automatically without registration. So what that implies is, if you've done let's use example poetry. If you've created a poem, the requirement is that it has to be have meritorious distinctiveness, mm-hmm. and it has to be an artistic work, which poetry is subjective, so it automatically falls in that parameter. Now, to prove that you are the author can be difficult, because, for example, you have situations where two people come up with independent works at the same time, even though they're the same, and then it becomes an evidentiary burden to prove.
Yes.
But what people are doing, if they think there's commercial viability, if they're a professional writer, is they do tricks such as posting the work to themselves, and they can prove A, the date of creation, and B, that it's theirs. That's very important, because an infringer will often say, but I created this before, and then you as the copyright holder, they need to prove that I wrote this particular work on date X. Mm. Now, another issue is that you get people who collaborate, and then you can't claim to be the exclusive copyright holder. That often happens with music, because you will get someone who creates the musical score, someone who creates the vocal, and someone will do the content. Mm. Now, the problem that you've got there is proof of copyright owner.
So on the question of music, there's something I'm going to play very soon. Did you want to say something more? Because I think I may have interrupted your...
No, that's perfect.
Okay. So we have something that's really interesting, Gio, and I want you to comment on it. We're going to play two pieces of music. One of them is by Sam Smith, who is famous, as we know. It's called Stay With Me. And then Tom Petty, this is a year or two ago before he died, he said that he had a similar song, and that Sam Smith copied his. So let's play Sam Smith first, Stay With Me, and then we'll play Tom Petty's I Won't Back Down, and then Lionel will comment because he's very musical, and then you'll talk to us about the law. Let's go with Sam Smith.
Oh, won't you stay with me? 'Cause you're all I need. This ain't love, it's clear to see. And darling, stay with me. Oh, won't you stay with me? 'Cause you're all I need. This ain't love, it's clear to see. And darling, stay with me.
Okay, Lions, that's Sam Smith, Stay With Me.
Oh, well, such a beautiful music.
It is beautiful. Yeah. Let's take a listen. I don't know if there's a great similarity, but let's take a listen to Tom Petty, I Won't Back Down. That's, what do you think, Lines?
The drums are similar.
The beat.
The beat,
the
tune.
There's a similarity, isn't it?
There's similarity in that.
Yeah. But what would happen? How do these musicians go about doing this, Jeff?
Okay, comment on that particular matter. I don't know the specific facts of.
I can tell you the end result.
What was the end result then?
Is that Sam Smith settled the copyright dispute with Tom Petty. Because there was a likeness, there is a likeness between the Stay With Me and Petty's Full Moon Fever hit, I Won't Back Down. So, yeah.
Okay, I'll tell you what practically happens. With these artists, they generally have contracts with record companies. Mm. And generally they sign over all rights up front. So whether it's Gallo Records or any other record company, they won't enter into a recording contract without an assignment of rights. And I'll give you a very good example which came practically relevant to this case. Is Michael Jackson and Sony. There was an assignment of his music rights over to Sony and there was a dispute when he died. Mm-hmm. Because they basically put out the money, the recording companies, and do the investment. So normally what would happen is recording artist assigns over the rights. So I'm quite surprised that in the individual capacity that it's not one of the big record companies.
It may well have been. Yeah. All I can say is that the case says Sam Smith, it may well have been his.
Now, in America, they have registration of copyright, and I assume that this case happened in the U.S.
Yes.
So what would have happened there is the sound recording would have been recorded with their registrar of copyright, and they could then prove who the author is, because that's more important, and then the chain of ownership to who actually owns a copyright, because most times the author doesn't own the copyright, they sign it over. Then what would happen is a technical expert would have to come in and see whether the latter song is an infringement. Mm. And because the two songs that you played are not that similar, because the words are totally different.
Let me just tell you what the end result was. The report I read says the songs are undeniably similar between the two singles, although Sam Smith said it was a complete coincidence.
Well, that can happen.
Yeah.
So, again, you'd need evidence, and one of the requirements for copyright infringement, including in the U.S., is there has to be actual copying. Mm. So you could raise the defense with an unregistered right of an innocent infringer that they never knew what they were doing. Mm. That would fall away in America because you've got a registered copyright, which is a public record, and you couldn't say I came across it independently. Mm. Now, the scope of protection you got granted with a registration, or as like in the rest of the world, an unregistered copyright, is not that wide. So the issue then comes out is, you'd have to prove there was actual copying, and B, that the scope of protection afforded by the registration would be sufficient. My view is if there was a formal dispute, I don't think the second song would be an infringement, merely because the wording is dissimilar. It's a slightly different genre type of music, and I don't think people would think.
You know, maybe these very talented musicians hear a song 10 years before, kind of sticks in their mind when they create the new one.
You see,
very often these songs are not really created by the singer, it's created by someone on behalf that sells the song.
Correct.
Yeah.
It's the songwriter. Yeah. For the big names that you are mentioning now, Tom Petty, etc., they generally have agents, and if they suspect anything, then they would get pre-authorization.
The question I want to ask you is, could this lead to criminal sanctions as well as civil? Or?
Well, I'm not sure. In the U.S., where you're looking at, their legislation is different because what it says in the U.S. is you don't have to register copyright, but if you don't, you can't claim statutory damages.
Okay.
So it means you can't sue for damages. Yeah. In South Africa, there is criminal copyright infringement, but that is for, and I'm going to use the term loosely, extreme copying. So, for example, it almost falls into the counterfeiting field. Mm. So, I'll tell you a classic example where it comes in, is when people make money presses. So they make that is criminal copyright infringement because it falls within the parameters. Mm. So most copyright's definitely not criminal, but if it's extreme, there is a provision for criminal copyright infringement.
If somebody steals your song and kind of adapts it slightly for themselves, is there a civil claim against them for loss?
There's a civil claim.
Well,
see, you raise a very relevant issue. You've got to prove damages.
Yeah.
Now, with music, it's difficult. With any case, I mean, that's exactly what happened when a while back Lawford of T-shirts took S.A.B. Miller, and they had the court case.
Ooh.
And S.A.B. Miller's revenue is shot through the roof. And finally, when it got to the Constitutional Court, this T-shirt maker, I think his surname was Norse in the Western Cape, he raised the point for the first time, excuse me, can you prove that my T-shirt has cost you losses and you've suffered damages?
Yes.
The Constitutional Court had a look at that and said, that's a very good question, very relevant. Mm. In fact, if anything, it's probably bought publicity.
Yes.
And if you look at the financials, they had a wonderful year.
Mm.
So you've got to prove damages, even if someone so-called infringes your right. Now, coming back to this music, the earlier musician, I don't know if it was Perry or who it was.
Petty was the
Petty.
First. Yeah.
He's got to prove that the subsequent song has caused him damages, even if he can prove that there's an infringement. It's very difficult.
Well, he's showing that Sam Smith has made billions.
But that's not proving that you've suffered losses.
Yeah, he couldn't have got that money because Sam Smith got it. Yeah.
I mean, the Laugh It Off T-shirts, it was very popular. I think the shirt said Black Label, White Guilt.
You know this, these facts, Lines.
Yeah.
You're nodding away.
Correct. It was Black Label, White Guilt since 1900 or whatever.
Yeah.
Now, definitely Laugh It Off T-shirts, they sold a fortune.
Yes.
But doesn't mean that because they sold a lot of shirts that SAB lost revenue. So you can't say that the other musicians sold because one's gain is not necessarily the other person's loss.
But their argument was that it's an infringement on the goodwill of their brand. So then there's that aspect of the brand
but
being
correct.
Dragged into
the issue is that's in terms of technical, it's a Section 35 trademark infringement, 34(1)(c) in terms of reputation and goodwill. The aspect is any form of infringement, you've still got to prove damages.
Mm.
And that is why it was held in that particular case by the Constitutional Court that even if there is an infringement, by the way, they also held that parody is not an offence, so you can make parody without infringing. S.A.B. Miller has to prove damages.
So can you make parody out of any song?
You can make parody from in the normal, because it's not direct infringement parody.
Yes,
you know, making fun of something is not an infringement.
Mm.
The only time it does is if it goes to the dignity. So if it's taken out of context in a negative way, you can show that your reputation and goodwill has been impinged. But for a T-shirt and a big, now the second largest, if not the largest, after the AmBev deal, brewer in the world, they could not show actual damages. What I'm saying is people weren't buying. What you need to bring that, what I call a causal nexus, the link, is you have to show that but for what the person has done, now I've lost money.
Mm.
So it's, for example, coming back to the practicals, that was a copyright issue on the T-shirt.
Mm.
They couldn't exactly say, because of this T-shirt, we are losing sales of alcohol.
Let's take a question from James Selby on copyright. He says, quote, "Hi, what license and memberships are required to record covers of existing songs?"
If you want to do a cover for a song, you need the consent of the copyright owner. There are musical representative organizations in South Africa, such as SAMRO, which you can contact them, and they generally represent musicians.
Yes.
Alternatively, you can go straight to the record company and get their consent. But you would definitely require consent. But I need to clarify that. If you're not doing it for commercial gain, then it doesn't have to be required. Let me give you a crack.
I want
to
sing at the school, at the school function.
If you're not doing it for commercial gain, that's another aspect. It has to be in the ordinary course and scope of business. So if you're going to do a private recording and you're not going to benefit from it, you don't need a consent.
Okay. Lange, you've got something on Brenda Fassie that you want to raise.
Exactly, because it's such a hot topic at the moment, where there's going to be a movie about the character Brenda Fassie. But then the former manager, or the person who actually owns, apparently he owns the rights of Brenda Fassie in terms of the music as well as the name Brenda Fassie. How does that work?
You see, you're going into another aspect, something called personality rights as well. Now, generally, the strict interpretation of laws, when someone dies, they don't have any rights anymore. But what happens, especially with musicians, it goes into foundations. So a foundation is put up and the heirs often get rights to that. And I'll give you a practical example. There's Sir Percy Fitzpatrick Foundation, which has Jock of the Bushveld, which is a very powerful and well-known book, which has generated a lot of revenue. And in Mpumalanga, as you go into Nelspruit just before, there was used to be a petrol station called Jock of the Bushveld. And the Sir Percy Fitzpatrick Foundation objected because they could prove they had the rights, and they actually registered the trademark, and they had to change the name, and it was Shell who had petrol station. So coming to Brenda Fossey, what would have happened is she's got an heir. She has heirs, right? In terms of that, those rights divest either in the foundation or in respect of her personal bequest to her children. So that's where the rights would lie. Now, the question is who owns those rights can also be up to dispute because unless it's registered and it's put in someone's will or it's a foundation is formed, theoretically, you're entitled to take commercial advantage of it.
Let's talk a bit about YouTube. We've got two questions on it. Colleen says, I'd like to use some YouTube videos in my training presentations and material. Are they covered by copyright? There's another one, but let's take Colleen.
Okay. When you create a video, copyright vests on it. However, when you put it in the public display for viewership. If you don't reserve ownership in it, for example, on the internet, like a YouTube, it's deemed to fall in the public domain unless you specifically reserve copyright.
How do you reserve it?
Well, you put a copy. Well, for YouTube, you would put a copyright clause in it, or someone say that this video
On the video itself.
So what happens is you can't take, for example, a big movie, a blockbuster, and put it on YouTube because there's copyright. If you have a look at the credits, you'll often say Universal Picture owns the rights.
Yes.
And those are pulled very fast anyway.
Yes.
But if you don't reserve copyright and you publish it in a forum such as YouTube, which is a free forum, it's not a pay forum, it's implied that that work falls within the public domain, and therefore it's deemed that a free, compulsory, and perpetual license is granted to anyone to use
it. Excellent. So Colleen can go ahead and use it in her training presentations?
That is provided there isn't a reservation of copyright in that particular work.
Okay, cool.
Because what happens, just last thing I want to say is that because YouTube is a free upload for all, often it's not the owner or author of the copyright who posts the video, and it's a third person, and they're unaware of it. That doesn't mean it falls in the public domain because the person who's publishing is not the owner.
But if you're innocent and you don't know and you use it...
See, one of the aspects for copyright infringement, because it's an unregistered right, is you have to prove guilty knowledge.
Yes.
So you could rely on the defense that you were unaware.
Right. from Nicole. She says, hi, I'm looking for advice regarding copyright laws. You're listening to the right show here. I'm in the process of setting up a stream YouTube channel, she says, and we want to name it The Fox and the Hound. However, there's a Disney movie by the same name. Would this be a copyright issue?
It's actually more of a trademark issue because there was quite a famous case in South Africa which held you cannot get copyright in the name of a movie. And the name of the movie was The Man Who Broke the Bank. And copyright does invest. But I can guarantee you, if it's a Disney movie such as The Fox and the Hound, there would be a registered trademark in that title. And the title would be in the service class, which is entertainment, the class 41, as well as in the class 9, which is the actual disc, which is the goods. So what she would have to do is to see if the trademark is registered. The other aspect she's got
How would she do that?
You'd have to do a trademark registry search.
Assuming that can it be done in South Africa?
Yes.
For something that's clearly American?
Well, it depends where her intended market is. If it's South Africa, she would search here. If it's overseas, she would search there. But The Fox and the Hound would definitely be registered overseas.
Worldwide?
Probably worldwide because it's a Disney classic. Mm. So she would have a problem there. Also, the last thing I want to say is even if it's not registered, if you've got a reputation and a goodwill, or just a reputation or goodwill, then you acquire common law rights, which are rights, unregistered rights, and because the Fox and Hound is well known, she would not be able to do that because the Disney company would go after her based on common law unregistered rights.
Absolutely. I think we've got to move fast here. We've got a lot to cover. Before I ask you to talk about trademarks, let's discuss some really famous ones like who hasn't heard of the Nike symbol, the tick and the words "just do it," the McDonald's double arch, Apple, the Apple on the Apple computer. What about IBM with its trademark combination of letters and design? The question is, what does it cost if you want to trademark something, and how do these people go about trademarking everything? And where do you do it, in which countries, and what's the cost of it?
The aspect of how do you do it is you have to get a trademark application filed. It needs to be filed in the correct classes with the correct goods description.
Do you recommend people do it through an attorney like yourself, or could they go and do it themselves?
Generally, it should not be done by yourself, because if you get the specification wrong and the goods description, it's a problem, because then you cannot enforce the rights. Mm. So you should go to someone who's skilled in that particular and experienced in that area.
What's the cost of that?
Well, it depends on country specific, because when you go overseas, it's expensive because you're dealing with foreign currency. And looking at South Africa, it's not that expensive because you are dealing in rands. It also depends on how many classes. I don't know if it's going to make me popular or not, but obviously if you go to certain firms, they're going to charge you more if they are bigger because they've got larger expenses.
Do they want you to register some law firms? They want you to register worldwide? Do they recommend it? Whereas you say South Africa is sufficient if you...
No, you see, if your target market is overseas, you should register there. But the costs involved vary depending on which legal practitioner you use. Mm. And I think that's a diplomatic way of saying it. It can be expensive. It doesn't have to be. It depends on who you use.
So talk to me about trademarking my logo locally.
Your logo would be filed in the relevant class, so... Mm. You need to seek protection. Mm. There's also copyright which vests in a logo. The problem with your logo is, although there's copyright, it's an unregistered right. So if someone steals your logo and you haven't got a registered trademark, you have to prove you've got a... Not only that you're the originator, but you've got to prove that you've got a reputation and a goodwill.
So like the tick, the simple tick of Nike... That's reserved to them under their trademark. Yes, no one else can use that. I mean, it's just a tick.
Yes, and it's quite interesting because when you talk about famous marks or well-known marks, the protection that you get is not only for the identical or similar goods, it's also for dissimilar. So you would not be able to use the Nike tick even for something like computers. Classic example is Rolls Royce. You wouldn't be able to make Rolls Royce pens because it's deemed a well-known mark. So your scope of protection is wider. It gets quite interesting because once your trademark is well-known, in theory, you don't need a registration because your common law rights suffice. But to get a trademark to be well-known, it has to have use. And that's why it's essential for registration to get it to that position. Okay, also, so if you don't have registration, it's very difficult and expensive to enforce rights.
I'm a new company. I've got a great logo. I've got a great this and that. I want to trademark it. Give me the idea of how long and the cost from your firm.
Well, first of all, you must do a comprehensive search because what happens is before you file, you need to know that it's available. So a comprehensive search you would do, and often that's not even charged for if there's going to be a filing. And from filing until registration, it's just a few thousand rand that it would cost. And that includes advertisement, prosecution. It's actually first the process is examination by the registrar, which is about 4 or 5 months after filing. Then it's compliance with the registrar's examination requirements. Then it's getting advertisement, and then all the way to getting a registration certificate. Well, the problem with that, though, is the time process from filing until registration is at least a year and a half because of the backlog at the registry.
Would my local trademark be protected outside of South Africa?
No, because the trademarks are geographic in location. It basically means that if you want to enforce your rights in a specific country, you'd have to file there. But having said that, for example, in Europe, there's something called a CTM, which is a community trademark. One filing covers all the EU countries, which is a bit problematic now since the UK has pulled out of the EU, so separate filings are required there.
Let's talk about domain names.
This is a domain name.
Give us an example. And
there's been a lot of cyber squatting before, and the best way to stop someone cyber squatting is with a registered trademark.
What is cyber squatting mean?
Basically, someone comes along and sees your company name or your brand. They go and look on the .za domain or the .com, and they see it's not registered, and then they file and they register the domain name and holds you to ransom. The easiest way to stop that...
Is that still happening a lot?
It does happen a lot. The easiest way to stop that is with a registered trademark because you can prove ownership straight away. One of the interesting matters which I was involved with quite a few years ago is with Schumann Sassel. Because what happened there is Schumann Sassel is a German company, and there was a Mr. Sassel in Germany, and that was his surname, and he registered the domain name, and he put pictures of his family on, which he's entitled to because it was fair use. The problem was Sassel couldn't trade with the .de, which is a German one, and they were quite upset there.
I'm sure.
So they had to actually pay Mr. Sassel a hell of a lot of money.
Was it disclosed, the amount?
It was a private settlement, but I can tell you it was a huge amount because they were losing more money, Sassel, without being able to trade on the internet. But coming back to that, when your name has a secondary reputation as a trademark, so, for example, Mr. McDonald's, you wouldn't be able to argue fair use. So even if you are Mr. McDonald's, you couldn't put your domain name out with your family photographs on, because the protection of a well-known trademark is for dissimilar goods and services.
Yes.
But I'm going back to the 90s now, when there wasn't this amendment to the law.
If you have registered a South African trademark, how long does it last for?
It lasts forever, provided it's renewed every 10 years.
And so renew means you've got to go and pay money?
There's a small annual renewal fee of very limited, less than 1,000 rand.
Let's talk about a man called Tapelo who says, I've been working on an idea that's under patent for years and I'm getting ready to build a prototype. I need to patent that idea. How is it done and how much will it cost, the patent?
Okay. Well, firstly, there's no protection of an idea. You can't patent an idea. You can patent an invention.
Mm.
The for an invention, for a patent to be enforceable, it has to be new, novel, and unique and involve an inventive step. It's under the Patents Act, Section 25. The aspect, though, is, and there was a very interesting case in America called the Alice case, which basically held that to get an enforceable patent now is almost impossible. Means that to get a patent which you can stop other people from infringing is very, very difficult. And the reality is, where patents have applicability is, for example, a molecule in a pharmaceutical drug, because there's a specific chemical formula. So, and you register that drug, that molecule. Mm-hmm. Now, when someone's got an invention, whether it's I don't know the facts, but let's say it comes up with a new tool. That's a good example, because that's what everyone comes up with. Mm-hmm. So, even if you get registration, which you will in South Africa, because there's no examining office. So, even if you filed for perpetual motion, you would get registration.
Oh, really?
There's no examining office. Mm-hmm. The truth is an infringer, all he needs to do is change it very slightly, and he's outside the scope. So often the best way to protect your new invention is to keep it secret. So if there is a specific formula that goes into making a product, you keep that quiet. And I'll tell you why also. Because if you've got an invention, you file a patent for it, you have to disclose the best method of production. Mm-hmm. So then you've got to show exactly how it operates, how it's put together, how it is, how it works.
And everyone sees that.
Everyone sees that once it's registered.
Yeah.
So it won't make me popular with a lot of the patent people, but that's the truth.
Well, I'll tell you something, Jerry. I watch avidly Dragon's Den. Do you watch that ever?
No, I haven't.
Okay. They try and sell the ideas to the drug.
Oh, yes, I have seen that.
Okay.
With the UK one.
Yes. One of the first questions that Deborah, whatever her name is, Whedon, I think it is, asks, do you have a patent for this product? Because everyone's trying to sell something mm-hmm. novel. And if they don't have a patent, the dragons don't look at it.
I'll tell you why. That in the UK, and especially in the US, they have a very strict examining office. So mm-hmm. what will happen is to get registration, the registrar will sit with a highly skilled person. If it's a mechanical invention, if it's electrical, they'll get an electrical engineer. Mm-hmm. And it's a hell of an issue to get registration. So in the rest of the world, once you get registration, it's a lot better than South Africa, because we do not have any examining office. So I can tell you something very interesting. I don't agree with that lady, because if you look at the official statistics in the U.S., even after the patents have been registered, and it's a vigorous and costly process, when they challenged, most of them actually don't succeed in defending the challenge. And it's very rare, even with a registered patent, to stop an infringer, because their defenses generally work. And that's post the Alice case.
There's a guy called Bruce Wiley. He says, very interestingly, he says, local and international patents can be very expensive. Hold on, where's the one that someone wrote there? I think it was Nikita. She says, if someone is only valuable if you can enforce it. So she says, in other words, say someone does steal your idea, do you have the financing to sue them for it?
There's another aspect. If you look at the official statistics, and the US are very good with keeping that. Of the patents which are registered, there's hardly any which actually the patent holder makes money from.
Mm.
So the commercialization of intellectual property is a major issue. Then to try and enforce it once you believe there is an infringer is difficult, because it's not an exact science, unless it's an identical infringement. And also, the big problem that you've got, even if you've got a registered patent, is the searches don't help, because for something to be new, novel, and unique, it has to be new, novel, and unique in the whole world. So if something which is confusingly similar or identical exists, even though it's not a patent, that knocks out your patent, and that's the problem. Because there's no way as an examiner, when he examines, he looks at patent registries. And generally they look at the US Patent Office and the Japanese Patent Office, because those are actually, by the way, free online.
Mm.
So if you think you've got a new invention, If you go to uspatent.gov and you put in keywords and the Japanese patent registry, and then you'll get a good idea. But the point is, even if you've got that, doesn't mean that there isn't something which is confusingly similar which exists prior to your date of filing. And that's what happens, is that no examiner can pick that up because they're not, I mean, you don't know what's out there.
We're talking to Jeremy Kingsbury. He's of KIGR.co.za. Very knowledgeable, and you've got a great website. Have a look at that one, KIGR.co.za. There's some good stuff there.
Well, there isn't really a website. It's just Kingsbury Grasser.
Yeah. Just lastly on websites, have we discussed the protection of websites, that question?
Well, the protection of websites, there's certain statutory information that you need to put on if you want to protect. There's also things, certain disclosure which companies have to put in terms of Promotion of Access to Information Act. For example, also the Companies Act, you have to put, often you go into a company and there isn't proper disclosure as required, even in terms of the Consumer Protection Act, you've got to put down directors' names, you've got to put down information. Now, it's subject to copyright protection, your website, so people cannot cut and paste, and that's a common thing which does happen.
Mm-hmm. So what kind of wording do you put on?
You basically will say that this, you know, material is protected, mm-hmm. Subject to copyright ownership, and then you put the copyright owner. For literary works, you generally put in that this is protected in terms of the Berne Convention, any unauthorized use. Manufacture, reproduction is actionable by the copyright owner.
You know that little C that you find in a circle? Does that mean anything?
Yes, that's the copyright symbol, and then but you have to put the name of the copyright owner. Which also is quite interesting because Cell C has got that as a registered trademark.
Yes, they do, yeah.
But they've got that because they've got a secondary reputation, but it's very controversial because they're using an official symbol, which is
Is there a C of Cell C similar to
It's identical to the copyright.
Identical?
But the issue is they're very specific with telecommunications. Yeah. And if you look at the field of players, there's what, MTN, Vodacom, Cell C, there's Telkom. There's hardly any. Mm. So the likelihood of people being misled is not much because it's a very specialized field. When I say specialized, there are not a lot of players in it.
We have a few minutes left. Is there something we haven't covered that you'd like to raise?
There's other aspects of intellectual property which flow from that. So, for example, counterfeiting, the common law issues of passing off unlawful competition. There's lots of aspects which fall from it. I can tell you, interestingly enough, when you look at share values of companies, if you do a proper breakdown, because in terms of the US, they have to for their IRS system, the major asset of most companies is actually their intellectual property. A lot of people don't put values on it, and they cannot then benefit from tax advantage, or alternatively, they cannot leverage against it, for example, using it to raise finance through capital. Mm-hmm. And that's been done cleverly in the past when Food Corp, one of the biggest food brand companies, had a management buyout. They actually used their trademarks to raise capital as assets. They ceded them to the bank. That's another story because then everyone knows what happens with Pamotzi and that liquidation subsequent to it. Mm-hmm. But
I think Lionel wants to, before we let you go, you want to raise something there, Lionel?
There's been one with Valpre where they were counterfeit factory producing water and pretending to be them. So how do they deal with such things?
Well, there's a bigger case. You're talking about water in the UK. Coca-Cola were hit massively because they were selling mineral water and they were actually using tap water. So it was themselves that were doing it. They were calling mineral water. Counterfeiting is a criminal offence in terms of Counterfeit Goods Act, it's very real. But funny enough, to enforce your rights in terms of the Counterfeit Goods Act, you need a registered trademark, a copyright, or a patent. Mm-hmm. Because it's in products, it's generally you need to require a registered trademark. So, for example, Valpre, I'm sure, have a registration. Someone comes along and takes their bottles and counterfeits their product, there's criminal sanction, but they can also sue civilly because that can be very detrimental.
So there's a minefield of stuff one has got to walk through on intellectual property. It's been so interesting, Jerry, and the time has flown. We'd like to thank you very much for coming through. Jeremy Kingsbury, a specialist in intellectual property, patents, trademarks, copyright, intangibles, intangibles, whatever it may be. Many thanks to you. Lines were a good one, wasn't it?
No, brilliant.
Cool. Okay.
Thank you very much.
See you next time.
Okay, bye bye.
Law, like you've never heard it before. The Laws of Life with Gary Hertzberg on CliffCentral.com. This is CliffCentral.com.